New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Megan Kamrick, in for Stephen Spitz. In June, the National Mall in Washington, D.C. was the site of a huge art installation, 1 Million Bones, crafted by students, educators, artists, and activists from around the world, were laid out across this iconic space in the nation's capital. The idea was to make a powerful visual call for action against ongoing genocide and mass atrocities in Sudan, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Burma, Somalia, and Syria. The project, 1 Million Bones, was the brainchild of our guest today, New Mexico artist and activist Naomi Natale. Naomi, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
These images of 1 million bones laid out between the Capitol and the Washington Monument are really stunning. Why did you want to approach genocide through this method?
Given my previous work, I'm interested in this intersection of art and activism as a way to invite people to build a relationship with an issue and build a relationship with an issue that might be physically very far away from us, but bring it home emotionally close. And to use that space and to create what was going to be a symbolic mass grave created by so many people around the world was important. It was important to use that space that's been used for so many different important issues and so many people, you know, who have shaped
Martin Luther King, the anti-war rallies.
Absolutely. And that have shaped, you know, where we are today. And it was pretty powerful to be there.
So the project was the culmination of years of effort by you and volunteers all over the world. What first started you on this path? How did this all begin?
It came right after the last project that I worked on, which was called the Cradle Project.
Talk about that for me.
Sure. And that was focusing on orphan children in sub-Saharan Africa. And it was a call to artists from all around the world to create a representation of an empty cradle. And it was through that project and really understanding how art could be used as such a powerful tool to connect people that I saw this project. I saw those bones laid out there. And it was important that there would be so many, that there would be 1 million. And, you know, it was definitely considered a wild and perhaps impossible idea to a lot of people. But we have an extraordinary team of staff and then volunteers from all over that really saw themselves in a place for themselves within this project and, you know, use that as a way to invite other people on board as well.
The Cradle Project, you were addressing children and AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, right? And the impact.
Orphan children. Yeah, at that time, it was launched in 2006. There were 48 million children orphaned in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, that came out of a personal experience that I had traveling in Kenya in 2002. And it was a way to kind of translate that experience in a way that I didn't know how to speak about, you know, here in the States and to people in my community.
What was the outcome of that? So how many artists were involved in the Cradle Project?
In the end, there were over 550 cradles that were submitted. And there was a story behind every one of them. You know, they were auctioned off and the proceeds were donated to an organization working, the Firelight Foundation, that works with orphan children within sub-Saharan Africa. You know, I think a lot of us working on that project had imagined that the greatest impacts that project was going to have with them was with the money we raised or when we were to see all those cradles in one space. But what we didn't imagine was this impact that it would have on the individual artists that participated and kind of the journey that they would go through, you know, putting their intention into this piece that they would make.
How did that lead you to 1 Million Bones? What were the things that you took from that?
Coming up with that idea, never doing anything like that before, you know, you just don't know, will it be successful and what will success look like and what does that mean to people? I guess walking away from that, you know, all of us who had worked on that project or had participated, really just understanding that it was powerful in the way that people connected to something that they had, you know, maybe never known about or thought they would have a connection to. You know, the issue of ongoing genocide was one that I wanted to address even before that project. So it was kind of like a stepping stone. And I had that idea, you know, towards the end of that project. I knew what the next project would be if I would have a chance to do one.
When did you first become aware of genocide?
It was the Rwandan learning about the Rwandan genocide that really kind of set this fire inside. And it was years after it happened. It was my senior year in college. And I read a book called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families by Philip Gourevitch. That is an extraordinary book because it's incredibly beautifully written. And it's so haunting and it's so horrific. You know, what he's explaining is literally hell. And it was about how, you know, over 800,000 people were killed in 90 days, predominantly by machetes. And when you think about, like, the human energy that it would take to make that happen, you know, is, and he described it, you know, doctors kill their patients, neighbors kill their neighbors. It was something that we can't even imagine. And the world knew, and we did nothing. And there were ways that we could have acted and taken measures to stop that without even going in. And nobody did anything.
I remember being in graduate school and walking across the street to a convenience store and seeing Newsweek or Time, and the cover was Rwanda, and a quote from someone saying, "There are no demons left in hell. They're all in Rwanda." It was kind of unimaginable.
It really was.
And it was not, it was actually around the same time similar things were taking place in Europe and the Balkans.
Right.
And again, not much necessarily done to prevent that.
Right.
I want to play a clip from your website by Desmond Tutu. He's the famous retired Anglican bishop of South Africa and a continuing peace activist, and he speaks about this project.
Bones are evidence of a unique individual journey. Each moment of hope and happiness, each dream and passion, and each struggle experienced in a lifetime. But they are also the evidence of a collective journey, the story shared in the human experience. In my language, we say Ubuntu. It means that each individual's humanity is inextricably linked to one another's. Your joy is my joy, and your sorrow is my sorrow. If we accept this, we recognize our responsibility to each other, regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, nationality, or religion. We must raise each other up, lest we all sink down.
That's an extraordinary quote. Is that what you had in mind?
Yeah, it exactly was, because the biggest component about this project was our educational component, because what we learned from the very beginning was how many people, students, college students, and adults, who didn't know what genocide was, let alone that it happens today.
That seems extraordinary.
It does. But I was in college classrooms watching, you know, the professor ask their students, who knows what genocide is, and seeing two hands raise. I was shocked, because I thought it would be more about inspiring people to want to take action about something they already might know about. I didn't understand how important the actual introduction piece of the education was going to be. And so the way that we were able to do that, and the way to bring an issue that's so intense and to find hope and inspire people to take action, was to use the message that these bones are to remind us that we belong to each other, that we're responsible to one another. You know, because if we can accept this idea that we belong to each other, then we can recognize our responsibility. And that was the narrative that we used. It was a complete grassroots effort.
You were reaching out and saying, hey, would your kids like to make some bones?
Well, no. You know, we had a curriculum that was developed by a woman who worked with us, Kimberly Bruna Lewis. Great job developing a curriculum all the way from preschool to 12th grade. And there were different ways that educators could approach these issues. A lot of times we wouldn't get a response and we try back. And sometimes they would be honest enough with us to say, you know, I don't think this is appropriate. And then we could have a conversation about how this was used to talk about intolerance, values, ethics, and respect at the young age levels. And a lot of times there was a change deciding to go ahead with it. And that's where we saw a lot of the really powerful responses, and were able to get a lot of the, you know, reflections back about how classrooms were able to have discussions they never imagined they would.
So then you basically had these little satellites all over the country, all over the world, making bones.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So how did you get them all to D.C.?
Well, that was truly an incredible feat. We worked with UPS the last year in terms of designing a way that in 2012, we were able to bring on 40 state coordinators. And those coordinators were then doing outreach and collecting the bones in their state and holding on to them until the final stages where they could send them directly to DC. And so that was part of it. And UPS was fantastic, and they really worked with us, and they really took this on as a project of their own.
If you just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Megan Kamrick, in for Stephen Spitz, and I'm speaking with artist and activist Naomi Natale. Her project, 1 Million Bones, culminated in June of this year, with 1 million bones laid out on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. to call attention to genocide. Most of these bones were made by volunteers, artists, educators, and students from around the world. Genocide is one of these overwhelming issues that people, it's an issue that they can't really get their mind around sometimes, and it seems too overwhelming to do anything about. Do you think in the process of having people volunteer to make bones that somehow that tapped into a desire to do something?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know how else we would have been able to go into as many classrooms, whether we were the ones doing it or somebody else was on, you know, the project's behalf, and talk and engage people in conversations around what can be one of the most challenging issues to talk about without people leaving depressed. Without this opportunity for action and visible action so that they knew that their voice would visibly be represented on such an important space among so many others. That was totally critical to the power of the project and how we were going to inspire people to actually take action. You know, there's still a lot to process from the end installation in DC, but the one thing that I really have walked away from, because it was pretty wild. We had people from all over fly in for that event, people who we had never met who had been participating for a long time. And a couple times we would hear, you know, wow, this project changed my life. And I didn't even know how to respond to that or even understand that. But I think what I'm starting to understand in those statements was that it wasn't the project that changed life. It was the relationships they made working on the project that did. It was the relationship they made and they decided to enter into with an issue so intense, and then asking other people to enter in a relationship with that issue as well and moving forward in that space. It's one of the things that, you know, we'll carry on with us with the next project we do.
Did you have some assumptions as you started it about where the impact and the power would come from this project, and did those shift?
One thing I really have walked away from as well as that shifted was how educators can be the strongest community organizers, because they're bringing this project to their students, you know, and if their students choose to engage, many times those students are bringing it to their parents. And, you know, even more so, a wider community. We went to schools it was a school-wide affair inviting parents or even, you know, doing side events elsewhere and installations elsewhere. When we look at movements and activism, I really believe that there has to be a component in the classroom if it's going to be sustainable over the long term and really change people's opinions and I guess their understanding.
So do you consider was this an art installation, or was it a political action? Are those two separate?
In this case, they were the same. It certainly was an art installation, but it certainly was a political statement.
Was that difficult as you sought to realize this vision when you were reaching out to donors or to others to volunteer, that they wanted it to be one or the other?
More so in the donor space, by far that was our biggest challenge, was finding resources for a project this big in a space that there's not many people willing to look into funding that space, because the art world doesn't really consider this art. And the activism world is really looking at measurable impacts, which this is a hard space to show. However, one of the things that we also were really inspired by towards the end was, you know, some of the funders we went to, specifically in the anti-genocide space in the beginning, who candidly said to us afterwards, you know, we just never thought this was going to happen, or maybe didn't even understand or think to understand the value of it, who towards the end did come on board in a big way.
Did you raise funds through this, and where will those go?
Yeah, so we were incredibly fortunate to, in 2011, partner with an organization called Students Rebuild. And through that partnership, the Bezos Family Foundation donated $1 for every bone that was made, up to $500,000 towards CARES work in Somalia and Congo. And so in the end, we were happy to see that we, you know, reached the top of that, and that money was raised. And And a lot of people were, you know, inspired to do more through that incentive. It was over $500,000.
Talk about when you get to D.C. and you're setting this all up. What was it like to finally see it laid out?
Oh, that's an interesting question because, you know, it was so intense. We had the mall for 7 days, which included the setup and the breakdown. And the event went over the weekend of the 8th and the 9th. And so the setup...
This is June 8th and 9th.
June 8th mm-hmm. and 9th. And the setup was so intense because it was in a tropical storm, Andrea. And it was one of the most humbling experiences of my life to see these people, many who I never met in person, our team had never met in person, you know, holding up tarps so others could, like, put the bones underneath them for hours and hours on end into the night. And so then we had the 2 days, which were still so crazy that... And then the breakdown that I keep saying to myself, I think I'll understand it when I see the video, because we haven't seen the video yet, because I'm such a visual person, and it was hard to take it all in the middle of this intensity of, you know, logistics.
You were setting it up in the middle of a tropical storm. The bones were made of clay, mostly. I mean, were they damaged by this?
Okay. No. A lot of them were made out of clay. Some of them were made out of paper pulp, and some of them, you know, got wet and they dried out, and they got wet again. But in the end, a lot of the bones did really well.
Did you have a chance to talk with people as they came to see it, to hear their reactions?
Oh, yeah. It was really a gift to meet a lot of the people who we'd known virtually, who had been doing so much work, who flew in, and to meet them as well and share that experience with them. And you know, one of the things that leading up to that event, we knew a lot of students made bones, I mean, from all over. But as we were preparing, because we had to we needed thousands of people to lay the bones down in order to do it in the time frame that we had. It's done as a performance. Everybody dresses in white. And so we were planning, you know, the mall was broken into 16 sections. We were trying to get a certain amount of people per section, and so it was really planned out. And when we were signing people up for their different sections, we started to understand how many children were going to be a part of that and being bussed in from all over. And, you know, when you think, the one thing that kept going in my mind at that point, it wasn't until that point that I started to think about how crazy it was that, you know, our children were called to build this symbolic mass grave to remind us of this promise we made of never again, which we've repeatedly failed to deliver on.
Since the Holocaust.
And that was, our children had to do that. You know, and the hope was that there were a lot of children there, but there were certainly a lot of adults as well, that they would reflect on that too. Because, you know, the work we decide is not for us, is left for them.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Stephen Spitz, and I'm speaking with Naomi Natale. She recently completed a 3-year odyssey called 1 Million Bones and culminated in 1 million bones made all over the world being placed on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. What kind of reaction did this produce? Did anyone in kind of positions of power who could do things come and see this, come and talk to you?
Yeah, one of our partners from the very beginning when we set out on this project was the Enough Project, who is probably the biggest organization in the U.S. that focuses on policy towards these issues, particularly in Congo, in Sudan, in South Sudan. And so we'd been partnering with them from the beginning. And then for this event, they led an Act Against Atrocities Advocacy Day, where a lot of the people who came into town, they worked with them to set up meetings on the Hill, and over 260 meetings were scheduled for Monday, June 10th, where people were prepped to talk to the representatives about these issues and about this event that was happening that they were a part of, that their community had been a part of, you know, as ambassadors. That was really important. It was certainly so important to us to have that piece as part of the event.
Has there been any movement in terms of legislation or House resolutions?
There was a House resolution and a Senate resolution that was passed focusing on Congo and promoting a need for the international community to step up and to look for ways that we can promote peace in that area. And so that was great. There was also a letter that was being distributed by Senator Coons' office in Delaware for an act for an atrocities prevention board and the need for that. And a number of senators, including Martin Heinrich, signed on to that as well. One of the things that was encouraging was that a week after the event, though we can't directly relate it to the event because it's been something that this community has been rallying for a while, was there was a special envoy appointed to the Congo. And so that was really important.
Do you think that was sort of given an extra incentive or a push by the culmination of your project?
Yeah. We can't say. You know, it's just impossible to know. Yeah. But it's something that the community had been fighting for a long time.
You know, I'm guessing, I don't know if you've read Samantha Power's book, A Problem from Hell.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. It's a pretty famous book about genocide. She points out that Western powers are often reluctant to use the term genocide and thus avoid intervention in these conflicts, which we talked about, we saw in Rwanda. Do you see the possibility of this project fostering change, and where do you think that would happen? Will it happen just because of seeing this mass grave? Will it be from the people who made the bones, who are now more aware of this issue?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. And that is, Samantha Power's book was so important for that space, because the problem is if we call it genocide, we're actually obligated by the Geneva Convention to act, which is why we never want to call it. But in 2004, it was the first time ever that our government recognized a genocide while it was happening and still failed to take effective action to intervene.
In Sudan.
It was in Sudan. And I think by doing that, we set such a dangerous precedent and a whole message to the international community that this is an issue we don't take seriously. And that was one of the reasons why I felt this project and this issue was so important to look at that time. In terms of change, I think that these issues need help from the entire international community. It's not something that the U.S. can solely be responsible for. However, the U.S. isn't going to act, as we saw in Rwanda, as we've seen in the past, as we've seen in Sudan, unless they hear from the administration or our representatives hear from their constituents. And that's why the education piece is so important, and why I will say, what was crazy was how many people didn't know what it was, and let alone that it was happening today. So what I hope is that this inspires people, to stay on board. And why it was important also to make a partnership with an organization who's committed to this issue for the long haul, as long, unfortunately, as it will take, so that people can, who then built this relationship with this issue and want to stay involved, they have a place to do so.
How many bones did you make yourself?
Oh, I probably made thousands.
Samantha Power, as we know, is now U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Do you think having someone like that in a position like that might change things?
I think that's huge. I mean, this was something she's been passionate about for so long, and definitely she's educated on the ins and outs and, all the different aspects of it, including working with an administration. So I think it's definitely a key change, hopefully.
She apparently was instrumental in working with the administration or persuading the administration in her previous role before she was the UN ambassador to intervene in Libya in the early days after Gaddafi was overthrown, because there was a fear that there might be some kind of genocidal situation. So I gather from that was the kind of policy wonk view in the news that it was because she was in the administration that was sort of pushed as a human rights agenda, which, has not been very typical.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So you're back in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
What happens now?
So during the process of this project, Susan McAllister, who is our project manager, and I co-founded an organization called The Art of Revolution, where we will continue to do projects that live in this intersection of art and activism. And we hope to launch a project in early 2014.
Can you say anything more about that?
No, not at this point.
Well, until you're going to stay in New Mexico.
Definitely stay in New Mexico.
What about the bones?
So the bones, a lot of them came back here. Our hope is to create a permanent installation in New Mexico.
What would that look like? Do you have any idea?
We have some ideas. We're thinking of land art. We're thinking of really a space where they can be seen. It's interesting because I used to imagine them in different ways, as opposed to just always being laid out. And the more that I've seen installations of them laid out, the more I understand it's important that the ones that we have, each one have its space to be recognized and to be laid out.
Why is that?
Because each one represents something different. It represents somebody's voice, somebody's intention, and they're beautiful, you know, and a lot of them are broken, and they're beautiful because they're broken as well.
Well, Naomi, thank you so much for talking to us. We've been speaking with Naomi Natale, who is the founder behind 1 Million Bones, the installation that was on the National Mall in June, 1 Million Bones, to call attention to genocide. To commemorate this project, Albuquerque poet laureate Hakeem Bellamy wrote this poem.
For 1 Million Bones, there has been no moment in human history when remember meant replace. There is no milk carton big enough to miss all of us. No grave mass enough for our grief. Survivor doesn't mean victor, it means alone. Left. It is the answer we deserve, but never get to the question, what makes me so special? It is a village of, I can't quite put my finger on it, full of waveless windows with only widows unexpecting, full of orphaned orifices that know not the joy of hide and seek because there is no surprise that's coming to get them, the kind of damage that hurricanes would wink and tornadoes would flinch. We are what is left. After we lose our humanity and become our own natural disaster, we are comforting, a blanket of body parts covering Mother Earth when she is shivering, 1 million people colder, 1 billion souls lighter, while we are eyes heavy with hearts that weigh a ton. We are walking trauma, our ice age of isolation, dinosauring each other until our parentless children's children fossil us carnivores. We resist this legacy of loneliness. We will no longer bury loved ones without resurrecting love. We will Frankenstein our flaws and our faith across the national lawn, harvest lessons from it in broad sunlight, fill the holes left in our community with machetes and missiles, guns and gas chambers, bury them with our sins. Connect beings by bone. Put people together, hand by hand. Murdering one makes a massacre of 1 million. Killing any one of us kills us all. Mother Earth is still shivering in our bones. I know because I can feel you in my marrow. I can see us in her morrow. Smells like climate change, but only when it rains. We are not survivors. We are the same.
This has been New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. Engineering was by Michael Hess. The show is produced by Joe Green. And I'm Megan Kamrick, in for Stephen Spitz on this edition. Thanks for listening.